John LaMattina was the president of Pfizer Global Research and Development, where he managed more than 13,000 scientists and professionals in the United States, Europe, and Asia. He is the author of several books, including the highly acclaimed Pharma and Profits, Balancing Innovation, Medicine, and Drug Prices. John is a senior partner at PureTech Health and a contributor to Forbes. John, always a pleasure to see you. This is becoming an annual event. We always get in the winter and have a chat about how bad things are, John.
Well, that's great to have you here, and I always enjoy these sessions, so I'm looking forward to our discussion.
Last year when we met, we were discussing the theoretical impacts of the Inflation Reduction Act as it was just coming into focus. Now the drugs have been selected. Companies are receiving their maximum fair prices from CMS for negotiations. How do you think companies are going to respond?
Oh, I think companies have responded in a variety of different ways. People have pretty much wrapped their heads around the fact that it's going to be less revenue.
Yeah.
And you know, all these government analyses that says, no, you know, over 10-year periods, there might be one or two fewer drugs. It's just garbage because if you know, they, and on the other hand, they say, well, if it's going to save $700 billion in spend, you're going to take $75 billion less in R&D investment. You can't eliminate $75 billion in R&D investment and not expect to have less productivity. That's a fact. Some unfortunate things are happening. So in the case of my company, former company Pfizer, let me say at the outset, I had a 30-year career at Pfizer, but I left Pfizer almost 15 years ago. So I don't necessarily have, I know a lot about the company still, but I don't have necessarily the allegiance. That's my disclaimer here. But Pfizer announced, based on decreased revenues, a $4 billion cut in spending across the board for the whole company. That's a lot of money, and that includes a lot. And they're not the only ones who have announced price cuts. J&J just last week announced the closing of a research site out in California to save money. So a lot of this is now starting to echo through the industry in terms of there's going to be less money for R&D. But that's just research. Now, the strange thing about the IRA is that they are only allowing a small molecule drugs without cost containment for 9 years, whereas large molecule drugs, biologics, injectables, et cetera, are 13 years. Well, that now has led to a variety of theoretical changes in terms of pipelines. It was theoretical a year ago when we talked. Now it's real. So let's start with venture capitalists. Venture capitalists are now starting to advise companies they're working with to say, you know what? You've got a portfolio here. You've got a lot of small molecule stuff, less large molecule stuff. You ought to start rebalancing your portfolio to do more large molecule stuff because you get a return on investment longer that way. And then larger molecules tend to be more expensive than small molecule pills going forward.
And there's less substitution as well because biosimilars are harder to make.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So when a day a small molecule goes off patent, boy, you've got generics in immediately. Biosimilars, it takes longer because they're not done the same way. They're done synthesizing cells or organisms, et cetera. So a big change, and people are rebalancing their portfolio another way. But another interesting change as a result of the IRA is a lot of times with large molecules, you would say, okay, we have two or three potential indications we can use this drug for. We're going to bring it out first for the smaller indication because we'll get it out there, we'll get it used, we'll start generating revenues for that, and then we'll bring on the larger indications later on. Well, now what's happening? Our company says, well, we're not going to do that anymore because once we get one the compound out for one indication, the clock starts.
Absolutely. That IRA clock starts ticking the moment, even if it's a tiny indication.
Exactly right. And so as a result, companies are saying, yeah, we're going to wait and maybe launch it for a couple of things at the same time. And so we'll wait a couple of 3 years. And you may say, well, so what's the big deal? What's the big deal? It's there for 2 or 3 years. That compound could have benefited the patients it was designed for. And smaller indications tend to be rare diseases, more niche, small cancers, for example, that you say, well, we just can't afford to do that now.
If you look at Keytruda, the first 2 years it was launched, now it's huge, monster drug, fantastic drug, really. People are alive because of it. It's so good with solid tumors. But if you look at some of those first years, 75 million the first year, 500 million the second year. It took a while they expanded the portfolio and got more indications before it became the big monster it is now.
Perfect example.
Yeah.
Perfect example. Now, if you had a drug of that ilk, you would wait till you had two or three of the indications lined up before you would launch.
You said something, VCs are changing their behavior. CBO published something right before Christmas, which caught my eye. And they said they saw no evidence since the passage of IRA that, you know, we haven't seen any action that's really changed. Man, we've seen no impact since the law was passed.
I saw that same article, and it strikes you about how little government officials know about. Of course you're not going to see anything now, because everybody's pipeline is moving along. You have compounds in phase three that in the next couple of 3 years will eventually get approved and launch in phase two too. Nobody's going to drop those compounds.
Yeah.
You've invested hundreds of millions of dollars in these. Those you got to get out there. It's earlier in the pipeline. It's in the discovery portfolios where changes are occurring, dramatic changes are occurring that won't affect things today or tomorrow, but will down the line.
When I read that, I had some pithy comments probably. Let's look at deal flow under $2 billion. Let's look at early stage, mid stage stuff. And when you pull that data set, John, what you see is huge deal flow peaking in Q2 of 2021 when Build Back Better was introduced. And all of a sudden you see this drop, 70% drop in IPOs, 50% drop in VC deals. Essentially what we see happening is big companies, they're pulling the big trees, they're making lumber. These trees are grown, but you're not seeing half the saplings being planted now, 10 years up, and there's not going to be enough trees to buy.
So truth to that, I think also what happened was credit also dried up, the amount of money to invest in funds. And so that made a difference there as well. But I want to make one point before we move on from this, and that is the insanity about this medically is unbelievable, because larger molecules are expensive to administer. You normally have to go to a doctor's office or a clinic or whatever, and you go to a doctor's office to get injected once a month, twice a month. That adds cost to the overall healthcare system, as opposed to going to a pharmacy and getting a pill and taking that. As you shift away from pills, you're going to generate more costs because more large molecules are coming, which would be great drugs, important drugs, and treat diseases, but they'll be more expensive to begin with, and they'll be more expensive to administer as well. So it's just all backwards.
Obviously, large molecules have certain applications which are very good, but one of them is not neurology, for example. Crossing the blood-brain barrier is quite difficult.
Hard to get things in the brain, exactly.
Right. Yeah. I was invited to participate as a member of the Healthcare Task Force of the House Budget Committee with Director Swigert of CBO. Peter Kolchinsky and I were both on this group. And we prodded.
And for your audience, I'd say Kolchinsky is a VC guy. He's RA Capital, and he's actually been a leading voice in all this. But he's not a crazy person in that he's written a terrific book called The Great American Drug Deal, which says, you know, we already have price controls in effect in this country because everything goes generic.
Right.
And so you have a limited time, and then it goes generic, and then the generic companies come in and the prices drop dramatically. And the other point he makes, which I quote all the time, is that, and by the way, hospital costs go up every year. And hip replacements don't go generic.
Yeah.
They'll go up 5%, 10% every year. Whereas Lipitor, now you can spend pennies a day. The generic version of Lipitor is atorvastatin. Atorvastatin, the third most prescribed drug in the United States. Hundreds of thousands of prescriptions are written every year, and it costs literally pennies a day.
10 years ago, the British government at one point was talking about, do we want to put it in the water supply like Florida? I mean, literally, there were discussions, John, about this. It was crazy. But getting back to our meeting with the CBO, what was not discussed and what CBO finally admitted, they hadn't looked at indications in their analysis. So you don't know the disease prevalence by age. And we're like, when you say substitution, are you then implying that these companies are going to be not targeting Medicare, where they're going to be price controlled? Is this what you're implying? Well, yeah, we do see substitution. And there was some mortified looks like, oh, wait a minute.
I hadn't thought about that.
So, right. You know, in their modeling, there's an assumption that companies may substitute, i.e. leave Medicare in discovery.
Certainly that's another thing that will impact discussions on what you want to work on. Do you want to work on drugs that primarily would be for people under the age of 65, that you won't have high Medicare payments on because it's just not used for them? So
you're at PureTech Health. Are you considering IRA now as part of your decision?
We haven't gotten to that point yet. I think that you have to have, PureTech Health is relatively small portfolio of about 10 or 11 compounds. Going forward, it might be something we'll look into, but we tend to be opportunistic. I think where this really has impact are the bigger companies.
Sure.
With a portfolio of 100 programs, 120, you know, the Pfizer's and Merck's and Lilly's that work on in discovery, at least 100, 120 programs. And I can envision discussions going on with the commercial colleagues who will say, well, looking at this, what percentage of these are large molecule programs and what percentage are small molecule programs? And if the balance is say, 60, 65% small versus large, I mean, say, you know,
you're going to flip it.
Can you flip that? Yeah. Can you rebalance this? It just makes more sense. And to be honest, in discovery, it doesn't cost more to do a program for a large molecule than a small molecule. In some ways, the discovery part can cost less. The development, the making large bulk supplies for clinical, that'll be different. That'll be more expensive. But in the early stage, it's a wash.
PitchBook, according to their data, 38% of all VCs stopped deal making in 2023. I mean, that is a stunning, stunning number. Are you seeing a rebound, or are you still seeing it depressed? What's your...
So I think right now what's happened, it's become a buyer's market with the VCs being the buyers. And that is, 5-6 years ago, there'd be a frenzy for a new startup company that had some interesting technology or an interesting early stage compound that people would bid on and invest in these things before you even had any toxicology data or before you had any clinical data. Now what's happening is people are holding their powder and waiting to say, well, let's wait and see how well this hits certain key stages. Let's see if it shows the necessary efficacy at this stage, at this stage, at this stage. Now, what you can see is maybe this is shifted, and once more these startup companies get to that stage, you'll see the money coming back in. I think the VCs will feel a whole lot more comfortable. And it's not just them. It's big pharma and mid-sized pharma waiting to see. You know, I don't want to invest now. Let me get more data so I have more certainty that this is going to be a chance of better than a 1 in 10 chance of success. Once it all shifts, maybe you'll see more deals coming in. There seems to be some movement now, so I think that's starting to happen.
But what you're outlining then is there's going to be still tighter liquidity. There's just not going to be as much activity as we had.
Hopefully that will change. I tend to be optimistic, so we'll see.
We're seeing 60% drops in leasing of lab space, drops in employment, 15,000, 20,000 fewer jobs in the biotech sector in the last quarter alone. I mean, it's really bad. Are the politicians starting to get hip to this? Hey, wait a minute, we may have thrown the golden goose out with the golden egg.
I don't think politicians care.
No?
So politicians care. I'll give you a little bit of my theory as to why that's happening in a second. But politicians, 80%+ of this country wanted drug prices controlled. Nobody really cared about hospital prices control because a lot of people don't see that. When they go to a CVS, they actually see they're spending more out of pocket or their insurance companies are more of a copay, et cetera. Doesn't happen as much when you go to get hospital tests, et cetera. Those all tend to be covered. They don't see that. They don't see the inflation going up. But everybody wanted, let's beat down the pharmaceutical industry. It's somewhat dated now, but I show quotes of Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump on the only thing they've ever agreed upon. And that was Trump in the first couple of years when he was president said, we got to get the drug companies under control. They're getting away with murder. And Bernie said, exactly right. They are getting away. Literal murder. People can't afford their drugs, et cetera, et cetera. I think, oh, God, when you've got that much firepower against you, of course you're going to pay for all of this with price controls. And I think that's a lot of what's happened. As for, it's a different phenomenon, I think, with the layoffs in biotech. What's happening in the biotech industry in Boston are the early stage of the companies that may be a one drug company or a two drug company by early stage biotech who now are getting to the point where they've got to fund clinical trials. In the past, they might go to an IPO to get their money for clinical trials.
IPO market's dead.
That's right. So that's right. So as a result, you've got to survive. You've got to get these compounds to market to generate revenues. So you got to do the clinical trials, which are way more expensive than discovery work. So what do they do? To conserve cash, to expand their runway 1, 2, 3 years out to get these compounds across the finish line, they're laying off the early discovery folks. And that's when you're seeing the jobs that are going, that tends to be where they're going right now. Will that rebound? If a company is successful, then they have to go back now and unless they get acquired, to go back in and and now rebuild a pipeline in order to have stuff to be able to bring through.
Yeah, exactly.
So I think that's part of what's happening there.
We're seeing larger valuations in cardiovascular. We're seeing a move out of the over 65. I mean, there have been a couple cancer acquisitions that are people who are naive and say, see, everything's fine. We're seeing a lot of traction in cardiovascular, John. It's partying like it's 1999 again before Medicare Part D, you know?
Yeah, so a lot of what's going on in cardiovascular tends to be in getting people medicines before they get into frank congestive heart failure.
Yeah.
And so that stuff starts in the 40s and 50s and things like that. So it's trying to move down. You got to have a broad coverage there. So that doesn't surprise me.
Given the fact that that also then puts the life cycle outside of Medicare as far as the time frame.
As what we've talked about, sure.
One final thing there. Do you honestly feel that in cities like Boston, there will be a rebound, or do you see this constantly just staying down for a while? I mean,
That's a great question.
How's this going to happen?
I'm hoping there'll be a rebound. I'm hoping that it's interesting. These obesity drugs, which are not necessarily for people over 65, right?
Yeah,
this
exactly.
is going all the way down, is having an enormous effect on people's psyches and thinking and investments. And so if you've got programs that can have an application like Wegovy and Mounjaro and things like that, these drugs are also showing that they impact heart disease, they reduce heart disease, and they're good for diabetes. They may be useful for addictions. People seem to drink less.
Alcohol addiction.
Exactly.
Yes.
People seem to drink less, and they seem to have an impact on what's called NASH, or now MASH, basically fatty livers, which obese people, and even people who aren't obese, can get very fatty livers, which have severe downstream consequences. And so there's a lot of excitement generated around there, and so a lot of money is coming in to invest in companies doing that sort of thing. Sort of like a rebirth of metabolic diseases in a lot of ways, which had been played out for a while when you had all the great statins and things like that. But now there's been a renaissance. So I think I'm optimistic. I think this will come back. I think more of it. But there'll be less money to invest in R&D than there was. But having said that, I think I'm hoping we're at an eighter now and it'll start coming back up.
If you look at Novo Nordisk's performance, right now the market cap of Novo Nordisk is larger than the entire GDP of Denmark. I mean,
exactly.
It's absolutely mad.
And Lilly has done extremely, extremely well with their drug. These are becoming $15, $16, $20 billion drugs. So I think that's doing very, very well. And you never know what the next hot area is going to be, and that'll generate a lot more money to invest in R&D.
So not only do we have IRA, not only do we have the Congressional Budget Office and all that going on.
Let's talk margin rights.
Let's talk margin rights in the wonderful Biden administration. Under the National Institute of Standards and Technology, NIST, they released a draft interagency guidance framework for considering the exercise of margin rights under Bayh-Dole. There's a lot of language there. Now, we obviously investigated over 350 approvals over the last 10 years.
But for the naive audience, margin rights is basically now the government saying, you know what, through the NIH, we invest in all sorts of R&D, and we get this great stuff, and we patent it, but then we give the license, the patents out to these big pharmaceutical companies, and then all they do is manufacture it and charge outrageous prices. Why aren't Americans getting a fair deal on all this money they invest in all these drugs that are coming out?
Which they invent. John, you didn't do anything at Pfizer, did you?
Right.
You just bought a patent and then that was
now,
it. Just licensed the print money.
Lo and behold, your group, Vital Transformation, did a study and say, well, how much of these, and so what margin rights are, basically for all these drugs that all these major companies are doing, we can go in and we're going to demand a lower price for them and maybe even set the prices for them because we're owed that. The American people's being charged and we're owed that. Now, what are the facts, Wayne? Share with me what the data shows.
Well, interestingly enough, there's a new tool called The Lens, and I have to give a shout out to our colleague, Gwen O'Loughlin, who was the one who figured this out because she was a grad student at the time finishing some post-work at the University of Wisconsin. She worked with the law library, and they worked with this new tool called The Lens. And what The Lens was able to do for one of the first times is you could put the government interest statement that you are required by federal law to have. If you get funding from the federal government to do research under Bayh-Dole, you have to say, hey, there are rights associated to a government license to this and blah, blah, blah. So that goes in. There's a specific language. So Gwen designed an algorithm using this tool called the Lens. And for the first time, we were able to search millions of patents for the government interest statement. What did we find? Well, first off, one drug does not have one patent. There are usually, as you know, John, their mechanism of action, their composition of matter. There will be several different
patents. Sure.
Exactly. So you'll have a panoply of patents based on various different formulations, time release, et cetera, just because you have a mechanism of action or a novel therapy that a scientist has invented, say, at one of our fine universities, that does not get you a drug. There's a whole bunch of other stuff in there. And what we found actually is you need to have, one, all of the patents, and two, they would then all need to have this government interest statement. And lo and behold, when we looked at 363 drugs, we found five.
Well, this is over what period of time?
10 years.
10 years? Yeah. Five drugs.
Over 10 years.
So we're talking about legislation spending time on marching in for maybe five drugs.
Yes, and it's not really five drugs, John, because two of the drugs are imaging agents of nominal value. One of the companies sold for $1.1 million and in VC back of the envelope math, lick your thumb, that means $100,000 a year of revenue. Okay, that's a nominal asset. There are two cancer drugs. We saw no sales for the last 6 years on either. They've been withdrawn from the market. The one drug that everyone's been pitching their tent on is Xtandi, which is the cancer drug. A drug that has been marched in on or had petitions filed on it a half dozen times, just that one drug. And the reason why it would appear is it's one of the only drugs you can literally march in upon. Now, 10% of the cohort did have a government interest statement, so there is government research there that's patentable. What's been intriguing, John, is it was very controversial when we first put it out, and we've had virtually no pushback on this at all. In fact, all the people who've been known critics are backpedaling furiously now and say, well, actually, oh yeah, sorry, just kidding. You know.
So there's no doubt that the research that the government does and sponsors, not just at the NIH, but around the country, is important for all sorts of reasons. It helps you understand diseases and get a better handle on things. But the fact of the matter is, when you do the hard work of seeing a hypothesis and then going, so what the NIH and this research does will provide a hypothesis saying, you know what, if you were to block enzyme XYZ, you might have a new treatment for depression. Let's pick that out. Okay, that's an interesting thing. But now you need a company or companies, because usually a bunch of companies will look at that and say, well, maybe there's something to it, and go in and do all the background research, which takes anywhere from 3 to 5 years, to try and see if you can come up with a compound that would actually do that, would actually block that enzyme. And then it is the biopharmaceutical industry that tests this hypothesis, that takes a compound and does the clinical trials, which cost tens of millions of dollars. And the further you go in the clinic, the more you spend to prove or disprove that medical hypothesis. So what the early stage stuff is great. And I liken it to running the first mile of a marathon. You don't run the first mile, you're done.
Yeah,
you don't go.
I win.
But each successive mile gets harder and harder. It costs more resources to the body, et cetera. And so it's important and it's needed. But if you want marching rights, it's not going to be anywhere near what people had thought to be. Now, just last week, a bipartisan letter was written by a bunch of senators and representatives to Joe Biden, basically saying, hey, you know what? Quoting your data, by the way, and say, you know what? This isn't that big a deal. There's not much to march in on. And then on the contrary, the last thing you want to do is turn companies off to the basic research that we do. Because since 1996, according to their letter, technology transfer that Baidu sponsored basically led to 6.5 million more jobs and contribute $1 trillion to the U.S. gross domestic product. So the people say, well, what are we going to get from this investment we're making? How about jobs? How about the gross domestic product going up? And this is true for all these kind of investments that the government makes. It can be true for Apple and iPhones and all this stuff.
Well, Google. Google was developed with two Department of Defense grants. It's one of the top 10 companies globally. That's marchinable. Their patents are marchinable.
Can you imagine trying to go buy an iPhone now in an Apple store and saying, well, you know what? I'm a taxpayer and your technology is based.
My phone's free.
I should get
this for free.
Yeah. No, $100.
Negotiate with the government for my iPhone. One of the things, though, that's interesting is, and we stand by this, and I had a debate with Jamie Love on Twitter about this very issue. If you're right, and there are only a limited number of drugs, and we do believe we're right, How can you then say it's going to do scorched earth on the rest of the sector if we march in? And the point is, even if it's a 300 chamber gun and you put one bullet in it, nobody's going to pick up the gun.
You know? Well, so here's the real cost of all this. And that is that companies will say, well, you know what? I'm going to learn from this margin thing. And so before I let my discovery scientists work on this project, I want to know, is there any government potential ties to this? Because we won't work on it.
Yeah.
And if you don't believe that, that's what happened when Bayh-Dole was first passed.
Yeah.
A few years after that, Congress came in and said, well, you know what? We want to get payment for this. And so the industry stayed away.
Yeah,
didn't invest in those things. And it took
Varnas.
Howard Varnas is exactly right to come in and say, this is stupid. None of this stuff is getting worked on. It's just sitting here. And he eliminated that.
When they did the CRADAs, the collaborative research grants, they put reasonable pricing clauses in. And no, when you were at Pfizer, like, no, you stayed away from 100%. And then as soon as the reasonable pricing clauses were taken out by Varnas, they did a big study. You know, it went up 8 times.
Oh, absolutely.
8X.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So that's the purpose of government. It should be investing in technology for defense, which is where most of it goes, but for healthcare and for improving people's quality of life. That's what this is. It's not meant to be a fund where we can generate money to that's the whole purpose. And by the way, it puts a ton of people to work.
Of course.
In this country and supports. And the United States technologically still is the best in the world. And that's due to all this.
How did so many of these academics, politicians, you know, Elizabeth Warren wrote letters, Bernie Sanders wrote letters, they did march in petitions. You know, I could name several academics in particular who've been front and center. How did they get it so wrong?
They didn't understand. They knew nothing about R&D. You know, and it's been a long while, but some years back, a bunch of us would go to Capitol Hill and we'd try to talk to various legislators we'd try and talk to the Connecticut delegation and stuff. And you certainly never get the senator. You might get a minute or two with congressional aides. And you try and sit down and you start with questions like, what is a patent?
Yeah.
And so this is a complicated area, and the oversimplification and the frenzy to try and get in. And I'm going to fix, you know, how many commercials? We're going to fix the drug industry. We're going to not let them get away with murder, et cetera, et cetera. And by the way, what happened during the pandemic? Who actually came up with the vaccines and the antiviral compounds in record time and things in the biopharmaceutical industry? And for those who were successful, there were a dozen more who weren't successful, who nevertheless applied to do this sort of thing to try and save the country. And for a brief period of time, for 9 months, the industry's reputation went up and got to where it was in the 90s, and it's since dropped back because the attacks go on again. They don't know what they're talking about.
Bernie Sanders and the HELP Committee are being very critical of NIH directly on these partnership grants, these CRADAs and intramurals, and they're being very pointed in, well, this is corruption and this isn't right. Those are direct partnerships. I mean, this is a Pfizer or a Gilead or a Merck teaming up directly with the NIH and doing co-development on usually a very cutting-edge platform. What happens if we start going after this, John? I mean, this is a whole different issue altogether. Well, this is order of magnitude.
So
that's really dangerous.
I again think that this is politicians not really understanding a CRADA. You know, a CRADA isn't an exclusive license to anybody. CRADAs could be given for the same idea across the board. It's competitive. And, you know, that's a great thing. You've got a bunch of companies working on something like that, exactly what you want to have happen.
And you're partnered with the government's a partner. They're getting direct, they're direct partner in the deal.
Yeah.
They get money from this.
Yes. Yep. So that's great to see. And hopefully, I may be naive, but I'm thinking now that these price controls are happening, and unfortunately, but nevertheless happening, and that more and more drugs, the government will be able to point to and say, well, you know what, we're getting, we're setting the price basically for, you know, it's not negotiating, it's price setting for all of these drugs, and it'll go up by 15, 20 a year every year, so that by the end of this decade, there'll be 100 or so, maybe more drugs that are price controls. And we could say, well, look, we've done that. Maybe now they'll turn to something else. Maybe they'll turn to pharmaceutical benefit managers or maybe even hospital costs along the way.
Well, you mentioned PBMs. What's interesting is the legislation that was being promoted actually was withdrawn this morning. We've been looking at this, some back of the envelope math. We're working on a project. I can't go into too much detail yet. We'll be releasing it, but we've capped out of pocket, and that's great. But now you start going after the PBM and the rebates, The only thing left are the actual insurance premiums. And you start cramming down the PBMs, you've already crammed down out of pocket. Again, we agree that's good, but I think some people started realizing, hey, wait a minute, we may have a 120, 140% increase on premiums here, and that's going to be politically untenable.
And hopefully they won't be able to say, well, you know, it's the drug companies raising prices. Because the fact of the matter is drug companies' price increases have been at or below inflation every year for the last four
real
or five years.
Real profits have been dropping right now.
Exactly.
It's,
right.
It's, they, they've been dropping.
Well, for drug companies.
Yes.
How about the insurance companies? So I think that's where hopefully the focus will be. We'll see.
The reason why there's so much rebate pressure is to try and hold premiums down. Because ultimately, it's not the person going to get a drug on Medicare that's actually, I know it sounds crazy with the out-of-pocket, but that's not actually the client. The client is paying the premiums. It's the companies, it's the premium payers, it's the people in Medicare paying that $110 a month. That's the client.
So insurance companies, PBMs and stuff, want to grow their profits every year. 5, 10, 15, well, probably not 10, but 5 to 10%. Well, what value do they bring? They're not inventing anything. All they're doing is negotiating prices. And so the spread between what the drug price is and what they're trying to negotiate is finite. It's just limited. So it has to come back to increasing insurance premiums in order for their profits to go up.
And if you look at Medicare Advantage, John, it's gone. It's certainly not kept up with inflation. And meanwhile, we have an aging demographic. We have increasing healthcare costs in hospitals. Yet insurance has not been keeping pace with inflation. So obviously the rebates, when you were running Pfizer, rebates were about 35-40%. They're up to 60% in aggregate.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
So where do you think we end up a year now post-election? We're back here. We're making this an annual tradition. It's always nice to see you.
I'll come back. it's hard for me to predict right now. Various pundits think one candidate right now will win and the other. I'm not so sure. A lot can happen in the next six to eight months. I'm hopeful that the price controls that are now being set will diminish the attacks on the industry. Yeah, Bernie will always attack, right? I'm hoping when I get a little encouraged when I see this letter that's a bipartisan letter to the president. And by the way, one of the signers was Chris Coons, who's Biden's best friend in the Senate.
And Biden supported IDOL legislation.
Yeah. Oh, exactly. Well,
he voted for it.
He voted for it, sure. I'm hoping that the focus will be off the industry. We'll see. Because as I said at the outset, both Bernie and Trump felt the industry was getting away with murder. But that'll be 8 years in the past. And hopefully that won't happen now. But again, I tend to be optimistic and naive. So we'll see.
John Lamantina, it's always great to speak with you, sir, and I look forward to doing it again.
Great sessions, great discussions, and I welcome you back whenever you want to come.
Thanks, John. The executive producer of the Vital Health Podcast is Dwayne Schultes. Our editor is Mark Brodeen. Our project manager is Gwen O'Laughlin. The Vital Health Podcast is a production of Vital Transformation, LLC, copyright 2024.